I love the sound of breaking glass. J'espère que vous êtes bien à notre écoute. Notre lunchtime en anglais continue avec la chronique Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro. I need the noises of destruction.
This is Bro on the World Film Beat, Breaking Glass, in my wind-up coverage of the Venice Film Festival. This is truly a festival that had something for everyone, with its top prize, which coincides with my top film, going to Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, making it by far the front-runner for this year's Best Picture Academy Award. The 74th edition had virtual reality, Hollywood mid-level and indie productions, Netflix, and a host of Italian films, including, most bizarrely, an animated up-to-date Napolitan version of Cinderella, caught in the web of the mob in Gatta Sarantola, or Cinderella's Cat. A major on-screen story of the festival was the concern with refugees, which accounted for three of the best films of the first week. I on Juliet, by Canadian director Kim Nguyen, is a drone romance, a highly improbable linking of capitalist technology protecting Middle East oil pipelines and a woman trying to flee a stifling situation. We used to celebrate technology as a savior, but in this film, in a way that is similar to the way the media is now often represented, everything has to go right and a modern miracle has to occur for the characters caught in this technology to at all behave in a human way, despite its supposedly progressive thrust. We've come a long way, baby. The artist IYY's Human Flow tracks the refugee question as Europe closes its borders to those who are fleeing wars from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria that the Western powers instigated. The film, often in exquisitely beautiful shots, tracks the plight of those fleeing wars caused by climate degradation or attempts to garner their home country's resource wealth. A stunning overhead shot descends slowly on what at first looks like ants, and then we see our civilians being rousted from refugee camps by Turkish forces in a deal that Europe had used to hide the crisis. The film, where IYY uses his status as an art world superstar to call attention to the worst migrant crisis since World War II, could not be more timely since, besides Trump's renewed call for a U.S.-Mexican war, the four Western European powers met last week and created a quota system, ostensibly to, like Trump, limit Muslims from entering Western Europe. And the Italian police in Rome thuggishly dismantled a camp of Africans fleeing war and climate poverty. Finally, the very wonderful documentary This Is Congo explores, through its tracing of four characters, the troubled history of that mineral-rich country, also a site of refugees. The film opens on verdant fields and cow pastures as a young colonel in the Congolese army says he will return to farming when his job is done. We then follow him as he is honored by the president, Joseph Kabila, little realizing the honor is about beefing him up as he is sent into the danger zone of the mineral processing city of Goma, where a rebel army has taken control. His bravery defeats the mercenaries, but he is then victim himself of the Congolese authorities, as his story truly illustrates why wars have infested the country for so long. The colonial past is rehearsed, as is the role of the West in Rwanda and Uganda in fomenting conflict and fragmenting the mineral-rich Eastern Congo. The filmmakers also had access to the rebel leader, who spouts revolutionary patter to disguise a naked grab for wealth, to a tailor who must flee the so-called rebels, arriving in a refugee camp with only a sewing machine, and to Mama Romance, a mineral smuggler whose stones are used for weddings. The country's history is rich in betrayal since the American-inspired killing of the true revolutionary leader Lumumba, and the film illustrates both the quagmire the country is mired in and an indomitable spirit of its people to continue battling and to try to right the course. Netflix, which as I mentioned last week was an uncontroversial presence at this festival, appeared with three lackluster selections and one near masterpiece. I discussed last week the disappointment of Our Souls at Night. Also less illuminating than it might have been was Cuba and the Cameraman, John Alpert's version of a 7-Up saga, where he keeps returning to Cuba over five decades to visit on-camera interviewees, including Fidel Castro. The film recounts Cuba's prosperity in the 70s, its desperateness as the fall of the Soviet system leaves it without subsidies, and its slow reconversion into a tourist economy through visits to a trio of farmers and others. As a travelogue, the film is interesting. As an examination of the many twists and turns the island has had to endure in the face of the U.S. blockade, it comes up short. A main Netflix event was its production of the Italian television series Subro, where the first two episodes were screened. The series, which, like the extremely successful Gomorra, follows a book and a film, all three in this case written by Giancarlo De Cataldo, details a mob attempt at a takeover of a Roman beach at Ostia to turn it into a port for the importation of cocaine. The political maneuvering involves the Vatican, the Rome government, and the local mob being leaned on by the Sicilian mafia. The detailing of this plot is excellent, but the series, in an attempt to expand the material and skew young, makes way too much of a blackmail attempt of a Monsignor by three youth, all disaffected, as the unemployment rate among the young in Italy is 35%. But here, emphasizing in boring, overbearing club music soundtrack their outre lifestyle as heroic rather than as what has been left to them. The series has a long way to go to achieve the casual and truthful cruelty of how the mob ruins lives and structures its economy in Gomorra. The revelation of the festival was Errol Morris's Wet Wormwood, about CIA mind control and assassination in the early 1950s. This six-part series is Morris's best work since his initial Thin Blue Line. And like that groundbreaking combination of fiction and documentary, here the fiction, which stars Peter Sarsgaard, enhances and emotionally expands the story of a scientist, an agronomist, initially wanting to enhance crops, instead swept up in the biological warfare which would eventually kill him, making the fictional component far more than a simple recreation. Morris's own interviews and revelations with the son of the assassinated scientist help penetrate an intelligence community quagmire that involves the Korean War, LSD, the CIA's own answer to Korean and Chinese brainwashing, and layers of concealment over decades that ultimately also involves a reluctant Cy Hirsch who makes an appearance in the last episode. The work is unflinching and brave as it follows the life-shattering quest of the scientist's son to find, as did Hamlet, which the series references, the truth about his father's death. Cold War revelations were one way of attacking the security state in many films at Venice. Another was Frederick Wiseman's equally triumphant and extraordinary rear assault on Trump and his neoliberal ethos in Ex Libris, the New York Public Library. In the best New Deal tradition, Wiseman recounts the ways this library system acts each day as a state democratizer. The library is shown as a vehicle to educate in poorer neighborhoods and to confront the digital divide in its everyday striving to ensure online access, in its highlighting job programs, and in its challenging its audience through presentations such as Richard Dawson's opening defense of the non-religious community, which he explains accounts for 20% of Americans more than any specific religion, and Elvis Costello's explaining why it was appropriate, in light of her attack on working people, to be stomping on Margaret Thatcher's grave. Wiseman painstakingly accumulates the evidence of why the state, in its non-militarist, non-financial functions, in the form of this educational institution, which sees itself as working in that capacity, is essential to the well-being and molding of communities in a way that gives the lie to Trump's celebration of a state which only supports a nihilistic and militarist capitalism for the few. One topic in week two was male violence and rape as it affected third world minority and indigenous women. This couldn't have been more timely as two American students here last week accused the Florentine police, two carabinieri, of molesting them after offering them a ride home from a discotheque. The Italian police, as I reported last week, are already under scrutiny for a Rome crackdown on immigrants. This kind of revelation, if verified, is also devastating to the Italian economy, which, not unlike Cuba, is highly dependent on tourism, and this summer passed France in profits from the tourist trade. The best of these films is the stunning Angels Wear White, directed by Vivian Qu, the Chinese producer of the equally remarkable Black Coal, Thin Ice, about the deterioration of Chinese personal relations in the country's capitalist phase. Here, in its presentation of a rape by a police commissioner of two young girls at a beach resort town in the highly industrialized Southeast, the film, which focuses on the layers of cover-up that prevent justice from occurring, enhances its story of the exploitation of women with an examination of how this pattern is exacerbated with the money ethos that is permeating the landscape. One girl is bought off with a promise to pay for a boarding school education. A young woman witnesses beaten by the police, and finally, the full array of medical technology is corrupted to keep the commissioner's power intact. The last image of the witness fleeing and trailing an iconic Marilyn Monroe statue illustrates the inability of women to finally escape this male carnage. Warwick Thornton's Australian Western, Sweet Country, has, in the instigation of its plot, the rape by a white ex-soldier of an Aboriginal woman, which might have, in the Clint Eastwood or John Ford's The Searcher's mode, triggered a more standard revenge plot, with the lone white survivor out after the villain. Here, though, it's the white system of power that is ultimately on trial, and the focus is on the cleverness of the Aborigines inscribed under that system in being able to outwit their pursuers. The film features Australian acting royalty Sam Neill and Brian Brown, but remains centered on the multiple injustices of the colonizers. Similar injustices in the U.S. South of 1944 are recounted in The Rape of Recy Taylor, where the stunning fact is not the rape of a church-going black woman by six white Alabama boys, but the fact that she came forward and confronted her attackers. The NAACP sent its sharpest investigator, Rosa Parks. Yes, unlike the myth, she was an activist well before her refusing to move to the back of the bus, and Parks' investigation was threatened by the local sheriff. Recy ultimately failed to get justice, and the rape devastated her and her family. But the retelling of this familiar story counters the corresponding myth of black men confronting white women, and affirming also that these kind of incidents did not stop with slavery, where they were a rite of passage for slave owners' sons, but continued into the sharecropping era of the 20th century, and were the equivalent on the female side of the equally violent lynching carried out more often against black males. My five best entries in the festival then were The Shape of Water, This is Congo, Ex Libris, the New York Public Library, Angels Wear White, and Wormwood. Worse went to James Toback's Private Life of a Modern Woman, Darren Aronofsky's repulsively incongruous torturing of Jennifer Lawrence and Mother, and Jim and Andy, a publicity puff piece designed to restart Jim Carrey's flagging career based on, quote, never revealed footage, meaning until it served him, of his impersonating the superb Andy Kaufman on the set of the Kaufman biopic Man on the Moon. Carrey comes off as a sycophant suck-up whose need to have everyone love him was the opposite of Kaufman's groundbreaking combination of performance art and comedy, where he really didn't care what anyone thought. Carrey spends his time terrorizing hairstylists and extras on the set and is convinced the celebrity privilege constitutes a genuine Kaufman resurrection. Pathetic. This is Bro on the World Film Beat, leaving the Lido and signing off from Venice 2017. Oh, change of mind.
Dennis Bro is the author of Film Noir, American Workers and Postwar Hollywood, Class Crime and International Film Noir, and Maverick or How the West Was Lost. His current book, to be published in 2018, is Hyper-Industrialism and Television Seriality, The End of Leisure and the Birth of the Binge. C'était Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro sur Art District. Très bonne suite de nos programmes, jazzistiques et artistiques, à notre écoute.